Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are back in our Washington, D.C. studios, joined by James Holman of the Washington Post. Thanks for coming in, first of all.
Good to be with you, Charlie.
We were talking about your newsletter, the Daily 202, Morning Intelligence for Leaders. I read this thing every morning. I think I have told you that. And one of the things in the back of my mind I'm always thinking when this comes in my inbox is, what time do you get up in the morning to write this?
There's a lot of news.
Yeah, there is.
And regardless of what you think of the president or anything else, this is just a very newsy era because it's an era of disruption. Yeah. And there was a YouTube video that went viral recently of a woman dumping a bucket of tennis balls in front of her dog. There's like 25 tennis balls bouncing up and down. And the poor dog is paralyzed because he doesn't know which ball to chase after. And that's how I feel every morning. I wake up at 2 a.m. I read all the clips. I look at all the news coverage that's out there. And I kind of try to make a determination about what's the most important thing that's happening or what can we say, again, whether you like the president or not, how can we explain this moment that we're living in? Because it's a dramatic moment. And what are the stories that are going to be of lasting importance that aren't just ephemeral of the moment?
And you have to choose what you describe as the big idea.
Right.
One big idea.
Right.
Every
morning. And so sometimes those are deeply reported and I work on them for weeks and weeks and talk to lots of people. And sometimes it's basically a riff off some story that broke overnight or an election result or something. But I try to say something to help explain the moment. And to also, my big focus is trying to look at the intersection between politics and policy. I feel like one of the problems with DC journalism and DC political journalism is that people cover the horse race and that's sexy. Who's up, who's down today. And then it's detached from the conversation about the deconstruction of the administrative state or actual real policy. So I try to the best I can extent connect those two and look at how they inform.
Well, this is what I wanted to talk with you about, because over the last couple of days, you've done newsletters about two Republican senators, Josh Hawley from Missouri and Marco Rubio from Florida, who are in the process of doing this rethinking conservatism, rethinking populism, Trumpism without Trump.
Right.
And I've described the period that we're going to go through at some point is that there is going to be this this big rethinking as conservatism figures out, well, obviously, we weren't what we thought we were. Mm-hmm. That whole small government, fiscal responsibility, free trade party, not so much anymore. So where are we going? So let's talk about first, the first piece you did was about Josh Hawley, who is a freshman senator who is coming up with, and these are very intentional projects on their parts, right, of both of Hawley and Rubio, to come up with a new formulation. And I'm trying to get my head around what they're saying. So Hawley is basically starting by saying we need to move past Ronald Reagan. Those ideas are tired. And we need to come up with something new. And he focuses on both the economy, but particularly on the culture. So give me your take of what's going on with Josh Hawley.
Yeah. So, he's the youngest member of the Senate. He got elected attorney general of Missouri in 2016, turned around, beat Claire McCaskill last November. You know, Missouri used to be a swing state. Now it's a state Trump carried by like 20 points. And I think he is very ambitious and he's a very thoughtful guy. He went to Stanford, studied history, went to Yale Law School, clerked for John Roberts, and
kind of a leady.
There's a little bit of a leap there.
We
went to Stanford and we had the same advisor. We both studied history and I kind of gave him a hard time for his mockery of elites and wine drinking and cheese eating. So he has come from this place. He grew up in rural Missouri. He's trying to figure out where the party's going. He clearly is very ambitious and sees himself leading the party at some point.
So he's Trumpy, but he recognizes that Donald Trump's not going to be around forever. And as a lot of Republicans are trying to do, they're trying to sort of retrofit onto Trump some sort of a coherent ideology.
Exactly. They're trying to put meat on the bone that's not just a cult of personality.
Okay.
So with Hawley,
yeah.
So he's sort of chosen these, I guess, top line, you're right. He said, it's not 1980 anymore. And
we are so done with Reagan.
if Donald Trump didn't make that clear. Yeah. So he believes there's a role for government. I think he kind of has this, you know, in some ways it's a return to the, he believes that government should be playing a role in culture. So the three big issues that he's focused on are taking on the big social media companies, saying Facebook has too much power. He's open to breaking up Facebook. He's taken a very hard line position on abortion. He got a seat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He actually held up Naomi Rao, who was the president's nominee to replace Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit, because she had written something actually for the Weekly Standard at some point that was soft, in his view, insufficiently anti-abortion. And eventually he voted for her by getting reassurances. But he made that's so part of his view is that government should be more muscularly shaping the culture, that it should be. The government has a role to play in taking on elites, limiting the power of elites, not serving elites. And he believes that all these government policies are built around helping the kind of the powerful. In some ways, what he's when he talks, he sounds like Elizabeth Warren.
Well, that's what I want to get to, like, that in just a moment, because there's a lot of attacks on big pharma, big tech, and sort of a hostility to the business, big business, and to consumerism, and much more skepticism about free markets than you would have gotten from Republicans. And there was a line that you quoted from him that really, I think, sort of jumped out. It says that GDP growth, gross domestic product growth, is not the measure of America's greatness. So, which is very much of a departure from Republicanism, conservatism, and also it did strike me. Well, hold it. Isn't that the way Trump is?
Right.
isn't that almost the essence of Donald Trump? That we can do all this other stuff, but as long as the economy is growing, then we're great.
Right. Stock market's up. We're winning. That's I think that he believes that there's still, I think Holly believes in the three-legged stool. Mm-hmm. He still thinks the Republican coalition is going to be social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, and kind of national security hawks. And so I think he's trying to figure out just how to rebalance the stool, but that's, he's trying to keep a home for those three coalitions. The challenge is, where does he, on business, he is sort of antagonistic in some ways toward big business, big pharma, and
Rubio is as well, and I want to come back to this. I also thought it was interesting his critique of the Uber economy, because I have all kinds of little papers around my office, among conservatives saying this is the future, this is what's great, the Uber economy. He is not a fan of the Uber economy. In fact, this is where he really starts to sound like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren when he's talking about the gap between rich and poor, and he's not a fan.
He's not. And so he says that what's wrong
with the Uber economy?
He thinks that these companies are exploiting people, that they're taking all the jobs and they're taking all the wealth. The Amazons of the world are concentrating money on the coasts, and that it's leaving these small towns behind. His example with Uber was, if you're driving, you get 60 cents a mile. Mm-hmm. But when all comes out of the wash, you basically have to spend 58 cents a mile on wear and tear and gas and all that kind of stuff. So these people are sort of being taken advantage of by these big corporations. Now, the traditional conservative view is, then don't work for Uber, or don't drive Uber. But it's a service, and if you have something else that you can do to make more money, go do that.
It's a disruptive entrepreneurial enterprise, which conservatives had been championing.
Certainly better than the taxi cartels.
Yes,
and so that's it, I think some of these things are still very protean. I think he's trying to think through. I don't think he has a fully formed sense. If you really sat down and you pushed him on that, I feel like you'd be like, well, of course I want to have innovation, but I want to make sure that anyone can innovate.
So he comes down, and you describe him as a culture warrior, that ultimately the politics is downstream from culture, which is not a new idea in conservatism. And he talks about the need to do something about the torn fabrics of our community life, which I think would be something that other conservatives would be very, very open to. And I know that there have been a number of really, powerful books along these lines, including Tim Carney's.
Yes.
And there's a lot of critiques about the elites and the globalists and a lot of that rhetoric about how they've been running our lives. And here's one. The new the big banks, big tech, big multinational corporations, along with their allies in the academy and the media, are the aristocrats of our age. Where did he go to school again? What was this again? The new aristocrats seek to, and look, I'm not picking on them, because my son went to Yale Law School. But being from Wisconsin, we actually do know. Anyway, the new aristocrats seek to remake society in their own image. to engineer an economy that works for the elite and few else, to fashion a culture dominated by their own preferences. These modern aristocrats often claim to be a meritocracy. Many of them truly believe they are. What they don't see or won't acknowledge is that the society they have built works primarily for themselves. Honestly, those words could have come out of Elizabeth Warren's mouth. So How is he different from the left-wing populists like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders?
Well, that's
already acknowledged he doesn't really trust the free market,
right,
and he does want to see a more muscular government.
Well, that one of the things is rhetoric versus reality. Mm. And I think if you actually said, you know, here's a list of policies, yes or no, do you support these things? I think he'd be pretty standard fare Republican. This isn't some iconoclastic guy. He's not. And so I think one of the things about Trump is, and I think this has consequences because language matters and words mm-hmm. matters. You have all these Republicans who are trying to channel the populist mm-hmm. anger and rhetoric, because he kept coming back to anger. There's so much anger out there. Every time I go anywhere in Missouri, people are angry and feel like things are broken. And so I think in some ways this is a nod to the anger. And I'm not actually sure that he has underlying policies,
you know,
that really deal with this. Okay. So I think he's kind of like, yeah, I'm angry too. These people on the coasts are terrible. But if you say, so you don't want this tax credit, you know, you don't want. Yeah.
Because you just voted for a big tax bill that really, how are the policies that you are voting for, how do they address these problems? Right. I mean, I agree. I'm interested. I mean, he talks about, you know, family, traditions, community. This is all great.
Right.
And you want government to be more muscular. What?
Right.
Specifically, what are you talking about?
Yeah. And so there's I pressed him on this repeatedly. Mm-hmm. We had a very long conversation mm-hmm. late Monday night. And it was actually, he's a very thoughtful guy. You know, he had this draft right. and he had written it out longhand on a family car trip from New Mexico right. to DC. And he was still tinkering with it and had marked up the draft. And I said, look, this paragraph, there was a paragraph in there that I don't want to use the P mm-hmm. word. I'm not accusing him of plagiarism, but I just heard Elizabeth Warren say something virtually identical, where it was like, you know, if you're a big company, Washington's working great for you. If you're a pharmaceutical company, Washington's working great for you, yeah. but it's not working great right. for you, you know, mm-hmm. and that's literally what he was saying. And he's like, well, the difference is that Elizabeth Warren wants you to be like her, and I want you to be like however you want. And he doesn't have a good answer. I don't think that's a good answer. No. I think he's sort of saying, kind of in that traditional, do what you want, live how you want. But I don't think liberals would say, Elizabeth Warren wouldn't say, I want you to be like me. She would say,
no.
I want you to.
Well, this is exactly what I wanted to ask you about, yeah. because this struck me as more of a posture than a policy.
Yes.
It's sort of an impulse, because, yeah, family, tradition, communities, I'm all in favor
great.
Of this.
Yeah.
And the resentment against the elites and the globalists. And of course, in the era of Trump, you have the anger against the globalists, whoever they happen to be. You may actually support their policies, but they're out there, these
right.
shadowy people
right.
that are responsible, the aristocrats who have done all this. You know, and then, of course, the anger against immigrants mm-hmm. and foreign countries
right.
that are responsible for all of the problems. And so this disconnect. Now, Rubio, and the next day you did, Marco Rubio is
the
coming
next
up.
Day I interviewed Marco Rubio.
Who also seemed, right. I mean, it was almost like he called up and, did he call up and say, hey, I'm also thinking of like bold new post-Trumpian ideas.
It's actually funny because I'm on a roll.
Yeah.
The person we're not talking about is, on Friday, I had a long interview with Todd Young, who's the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, Indiana Senator, Marine guy. And he and I had a long conversation about the use of force and rebalancing power and how Congress needs. And he's terrified about going to war in Venezuela. He's very cautious on the use of military force, which is also a break mm-hmm. from kind of the traditional hawkish Republican approach mm-hmm. to foreign policy. So then it just ended up happening that kind of 3 days in a row, mm-hmm. I was talking to conservatives who were trying to innovate conservatism in their own ways. Interestingly, Rubio. Also, Rubio had been working on this report, and they mm-hmm. so it wasn't that he was just responding to Holly.
Okay.
Rubio had, they had actually sent me 2 weeks ago a draft of this 38-page report, which is a very detailed, meaty, substantive
yeah.
report.
This has some policy substance
to it.
Yes.
And it tracks, what it does is it tracks the decline in public investment in kind of the heartland, and it says non-financial companies aren't investing in their workers, they're mm-hmm. not investing in equipment, they're not
right.
you know, they're not doing things that companies used to do. And then it's sort of it's this very long, almost academic critique of, shareholder enrichment theory or whatever it's called from the 1970s that's taught in business school mm-hmm. and how shareholder primacy theory.
Yeah.
And so it's a single space, well, 38 pages.
Right.
So Rubio they'd sent me the report and said, please read this. The senator would love to talk to you about it the day before he releases his report. And so I kind of already had that arranged when I heard from Holly, but it was interesting because one of the first things Rubio said without prompting, just like Holly had, was we can't measure America by GDP. He used that same language. And I don't think he was copying Holly. I think that's sort of the zeitgeist in the party right now is even though Donald Trump's saying the stock market's booming, job unemployment's never been lower. There's this sense that that's not enough. And Rubio and Holly both start from that place and go a little bit differently.
Right. And I think there's something healthy to this because, you know, I watched as the conservative movement / Republican Party in many ways became a complete creature of the Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
Now, the Chamber of Commerce is sometimes right on things, but they began to really internalize the idea that what is good for General Motors is good for America. And that became almost a knee-jerk approach. So Rubio attacks all of these CEOs, which you point out very pointedly, he doesn't name any of them, for making these deals with China, short-term gain, long-term loss. But you just mentioned this, because I wrote down in my notes, the key big thought here is his attack on this idea of shareholder primacy theory, which is, and this goes back to Milton Friedman. I mean, this is a Milton Friedman. In fact, I actually printed this out about 6 months ago as sort of the moment when I think the conservative movement may have taken a wrong turn, which was to say that business doesn't have any social obligations, that its only job was to maximize profit and maximize shareholder return. And that really did seep into the culture and into the ideology that whatever big business wanted was okay. We were going to support them. And if there were negative social cultural consequences, that's not their job. Mm-hmm. And Rubio is going back to that fundamental Milton Friedman principle and saying that was a wrong turn.
He was.
So that's a big thing.
Yeah, it is. And from a conservative point of view, he's on to something there.
Right.
Because it
different
is
definition
companies
of conservative.
Have disregarded, mm-hmm. they've disregarded kind of the interests of their workers and their customers. And the other part of it that is, I think, thoughtful is that short-termism is bad. Like we kind of, it was funny because when Rubio and I were talking, it became a cultural critique. He started talking about how there's too much of a desire for instant gratification in American culture and how the media isn't, you know, the video games, the internet, social media, that people want what they want right now. And he tied that to the shareholder primacy conversation, which was executives have every incentive to get their bonuses to maximize profit for that quarter. So companies are thinking about quarterly results, not mm-hmm. kind of where are we going to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And as Rubio said to me, you know, a CEO can make a bad deal with China where they give away their intellectual property because in 10 years, he's not going to be the CEO anymore. And he's going to have made hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think that there is something fundamentally conservative about saying, you know, where people should be stewards of what they're leading, of companies, of, you know, if you're in a position of authority and responsibility, you have a moral obligation to look out for the people who work for you,
which is a fundamental conservative mm-hmm. value, and once did actually I think dominate thinking about capitalism. But capitalism has always been, you know, the dilemma, the paradox is it's creative destruction.
Right.
And up until very recently, I think conservatives and Republicans, pro-free market folks, focused on the first word, the creative part, and downplayed the second word, which was the destruction part.
That's such a good point.
And so I do think that you're looking at both ends of that formula. So I find this to be thoughtful. He's basically saying that we need to have a bias in our policy for creating strong and stable jobs, you know, not just, you know, catering to these corporate executives, he doesn't name them, but to have a pro-work agenda. And he does seem to have thought through what the tax implications would be, although it's certainly not clear that the tax bill that Republicans just passed and that Marco Rubio voted for does what he says. Now, he didn't get everything he wanted.
I pressed him on that.
Yeah.
That was his answer. And he said, you know, if we'd gotten the family tax credits, it would have been better. And he wants full expensing for investing mm-hmm. in facilities, not just full expensing for research and development. But you're right. Fundamentally, he didn't really reckon with the fact that, like, if you actually wanted to overhaul the entire tax code in a way that accomplished what he's talking about, you would have done it very differently than cutting the top line corporate rate from 35% to 21%. That's, you know, and it's interesting because he is critical of the tax bill, which he admits he voted right. for. The very first page, the flyleaf of his 38-page report, is actually the transcript of a Q&A. The Wall Street Journal had this event with Gary Cohn when he was still the National Economic Council director. And he's being interviewed by a top editor at the Journal. And it's a CEO conference. So it's to a room of CEOs. And it's right before the tax cuts are going to pass. And Gary Cohn says, how many of you in this room are going to invest the money that you get from the tax cuts into your workers or into new facilities or whatever? And like no hands in the room go up. And he's like, really? Really? No one? There's no hands?
You would think they would at least pretend.
I know, exactly. Right? But they didn't. Mm. And so that's how Rubio starts the report, and saying this is really bad that these executives got this tax windfall. Massive, you know, they're saving billions of dollars a year in taxes. And even going in, they didn't even have this mentality of like, oh, we should take that money and put it into making our businesses better. Instead, it was let's do share buybacks or let's pay ourselves more or let's pay a dividend or, you know, whatever. And I think he recognizes that was really problematic.
He also you quote him as saying that he thinks the trade war right now that we're having right now is worth it, which is also a little bit jarring to see a conservative like Marco right. Rubio endorse what may turn out to be a very extensive trade right. war based on massive taxes on American consumers. He unlike Donald Trump, understands who pays tariffs.
He does.
Right?
He gets it. Yeah. And there's some politics being played by Marco Rubio. I don't want to guess his motives, but. I bet if you put him on Truth Serum, he'd be like, yeah. This
yeah.
But he, to his, in his defense, he has been consistently hard line on China. This isn't he was in 2016. He was critical of China in more than a talking point way. And he has been out there even before the Trump era saying these deals with China are bad. Not like Trump would say right. it. We're getting screwed and that kind of a thing. But Rubio has, I think, recognized that China's a problem. And remember one of his main animating principles, he is just sort of as a national security hawk.
Sure.
And I think he has identified a rising China as a, if not an existential, a very real threat.
It is.
Yeah. And so I think that it absolutely is. And that perspective, I think the national security perspective then seeped over into his economic perspective, which is like, we're giving away the store to China. We're feeding them all this rope that they're right. going to hang us with. So I think that is a legitimate concern. But then, and so the kicker of my piece is him saying, yeah, like this is going to hurt people. And I get, and he was like, I'm not like Trump. I get that this is a tax on American consumers, but if we capitulate, we're going to, and I don't know that he's right. I'm not defending him, but
right.
if we capitulate, we're going to pay the price for two generations of Americans who are have an imbalance. And so he kept using the word equilibrium vis-a-vis China.
I'm just fascinated by just the role of miscalculation in starting wars, including trade wars. And we've now sort of backed ourselves into this. Well, we can't give up because then we would lose two generations. And the Chinese are going, hey, we've been doing this for 5,000 years and we have a much longer thing and we obviously can't back down. And suddenly we have these billions of dollars of taxes that are going to be paid for by the folks that shop at Walmart.
Right.
You know, it's, I mean, the coastal elites are not going to be suffering because the cost of dryers and washing machines has gone up. Okay, so sort of going back to Josh Hawley being a, you know, talking about culture and being a culture warrior, we are in the midst of a culture war. And it's like, think about where we're at here. In May 2019, we have gone through this period of intense tribalization, polarization in our politics. So what do we really need? We need a full-out, full-throated debate about abortion, right? Because things I mean, forget the debate about breaking up Facebook or everything. Right. So you have been writing also about what is going on. The Democrats in places like New York had moved to a very maximalist position on abortion, pushing through legislation that would make late-term abortions, easier and more legal. Before the blackface controversy, right. the governor of Virginia seemed to be edging closer to post-birth abortions. was in some circles known as infanticide. And now you have the legislatures in Georgia and Ohio and, you know, most dramatically in Alabama passing these really strong anti-abortion pieces of legislation. So where are we at here? Because it feels like that debate is going to become central in 2020, but it also feels much more intense than we've ever seen it before.
Yeah, and I think it's intense for a couple of reasons. One is the polarization and the tribalism. Two is Brett Kavanaugh getting confirmed to the Supreme Court makes a difference. You know, Anthony Kennedy was the fifth vote in Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992 that basically upheld Roe. And so there is some uncertainty about what's going to happen. I even if there's not a Supreme Court decision that invalidates that 1972 precedent, that there's this belief on the pro-life activist level that we really can move back, you know, roll back some of this existing law. And there's this, I think, excitement among a lot of these activists that they've had Republican control a lot of these states for years, and now they can do something about it. So that's happening. And then on the Democratic side, there is this lurch to the left. There's a race to the, you know, every abortion's always been a litmus test in some ways for Democrats. I mean, we've had so many random litmus tests so far this year in the Democratic field, from packing the Supreme Court to reparations for, you know, there's just all these things. Every week it feels like there's a new ending the filibuster in the Senate. You have to kind of be for it. And I think abortion is one of those issues where in this post Me Too era, in the post Donald Trump era, it is very hard to be a Democrat with national ambitions and not have a very strident, hardline, almost absolutist position.
Okay, strident, hardline, absolutist. Who are we talking about?
Yeah, so the person that I profile in the Daily 202 is Kirsten Gillibrand. So she's one of the several Democratic senators running for president. Among the senators, she's caught the least traction.
Yeah.
She's kind of struggled to raise money.
Pretty much 0% in the polls.
0% in the polls. And she has Hillary Clinton's old Senate seat. Yeah. So she really has struggled, and she's identified this abortion issue as her ticket to elevate herself in the debate, and recognizes there's all this energy around it. And so she is down in Georgia campaigning against the Georgia heartbeat bill.
Not Alabama. Interesting.
So yeah, maybe because Atlanta's a hub.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Easier to get there.
So she's using a speech in Georgia to speak out against all these new laws that are passing from Missouri to Ohio and Louisiana. There's a lot of places where they're moving things. And so she's saying, if you're not 100% pro-choice, you're anti-woman.
What does 100% pro-choice
to her
mean?
I think that means across the board, let women make all those decisions up until the very end. That's where she is. And so she's putting pressure on some of the other candidates to kind of stake out that position. And also it's sort of like with the Republicans, we were talking about what's rhetoric and what's reality. And so the rhetoric matters and the words matter. So Republicans feel like they need to talk like populists more.
Right.
And one of the most striking things about going to Democratic events, every weekend I'm in one of the early states going to a bunch of rallies. And I've just been so struck at one, how people are actually talking about abortion in a way. Like Hillary Clinton really didn't talk much about abortion in her speech in the early states. Like it would come up, but they're talking about it differently than they used to. The old Democratic message was safe, legal, and rare.
Right.
And you would see you would have a lot of throat clearing. If someone at an event in Ohio asked, are you pro-life or pro-choice? Even wherever that person was coming from, because they knew that people were watching, the candidate would say, look, this is an incredibly painful and difficult issue. I understand how hard it is. It's complicated. I understand that there's religious views that are strong and passionate. My personal view is that, you know, they would say we need to have abortion rights and, you know, we need to respect women. But they would kind of equivocate and twist themselves.
At least acknowledge the complexity of the issue, the nuances of the issue, the moral stress.
The moral stress. Yeah. So that's And there's lots and lots of examples of that. It'll be interesting to see, because we haven't heard Joe Biden talk a lot about abortion. Joe Biden first elected to the United States Senate in 1972.
Right.
He, you know, is a Catholic, came of age at a time. He's not been consistent on this issue over the years. Mm-hmm. At one point, I think he supported the Hyde Amendment. And so he is of that old school Democratic generation. And, you know, frankly, Barack Obama was talked that way, too. He was very cautious when mm-hmm. he would get an abortion question. You think about someone like John Kerry. And the Democratic field this time, much less.
Really?
Much less of that.
See, because I do think that there's a, this is always, and it seems like it's getting worse, but there is a kind of a mushy consensus, which is that among people who are pro-choice, the least acknowledging, I wouldn't do it because, you know, it's a child, and at least acknowledging the complexity of the issue. I think that's where the vast majority of people are. But what you're saying is the Democrats are feeling they can't even engage in that throat clearing. It's got to be, we are 100% down the line. You know, I want to talk about the bad politics of what the Republicans are doing in Alabama. But it strikes me that Democrats are losing the argument when they are endorsing abortion as a positive good and talking about late-term abortions.
And so the question, yeah, when you're endorsing abortion as a positive good, you are in territory where it is, you know, a majority of Americans say they think people should generally have access to abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know, when you start going down on life of the mother, of course, that's overwhelming. You know, there's all these things.
Sure.
And I do think once they get into that territory, the way you frame it is good. If you're talking about abortion as a positive good, as a good, you know, it's liberating, you know, as you kind of tie it to like a women's liberation argument, that is a politically dangerous place to be in, especially for Democrats who are trying to win back the industrial Midwest. That's not an argument that plays well in Wisconsin and, you know, the Fox Valley or the Milwaukee suburbs.
But again, also, you do have this radicalization, and I know the people, there are people who hate this term, both sides, but it is a radicalization on both sides. The Alabama bill is truly extraordinary. Of course, the Alabama Republican Party, last time we checked in, they were giving us Roy Moore as a candidate. But they have gone far beyond the other states, and it's interesting that I think pro-lifers are very, very divided on this, about the strategy, that they're much more comfortable with, say, the heartbeat bill in Georgia. Alabama is in many ways the worst case scenario, the worst case that you would want to be in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And if I'm a Democrat, which I'm not, I would focus on this because I think the backlash to the Alabama bill, which has no exceptions for rape or incest, is almost a caricature of an anti-abortion piece of legislation.
99-year prison sentences for doctors who perform abortions.
Yeah. Longer than for the rapist.
Right. And so, yes, that's Democrats. If Democrats are talking about that, because that's what they want to talk about.
Yeah.
Democrats don't want to talk about.
Sure.
You know, Democrats don't want to have to answer questions about whether they support infanticide, you know, in quotes.
Well, understandably.
Right. And so they'll talk about Alabama all day. And that's an easy thing. Even, you know, I talked about how Joe Biden has a checkered record. Biden would love to talk about Alabama all day.
Yeah.
And it's sort of hard. Judicially to stake out.
Well, what do other Democrats around the country? What does Martha McSally say about the Alabama bill?
So what does
Cory Gardner?
We went up to him yesterday in the Senate, and you know, their answer yesterday, they don't want to alienate pro-lifers, so they didn't. Martha McSally said, "I'm not going to tell Alabama how to run their state. I'm focused on what I'm doing for Arizona." Tom Tillis said something similar. Cory Gardner didn't talk about it at all. But interestingly, you mentioned that, you know, there is this debate among evangelicals, among the pro-life community. Mm-hmm. So Pat Robertson,
I saw it, said
it was extreme, that it was too far.
Oh, man, where you have lost Pat Robertson on extremism. I mean,
Ralph Reed was out there yesterday saying this isn't a smart strategy. You know, and Ralph Reed's from Georgia.
Right.
So he was saying the Georgia approach is the right approach. It's a debate we can win, and it's good policy. And so that... I like your point that this is like the caricature of what the pro-choice folks are saying. This is what Republicans want to do. You know, if they get their way, it's going to be this.
And
they can just hammer on that. And it does kind of appeal to some of the suburban moderate women in places like Mountain Brook, Alabama, and the Birmingham suburbs.
Well, the pro-life movement has, I think, not gotten enough credit for its prudence of its incrementalist strategy, which now is, you know, maybe people have become impatient with it. But incrementalism has been successful in beginning to change public opinion, changing hearts and minds, reducing the number of abortions. And then suddenly, to shove through a bill that says, you know, the Alabama bill runs the risk of setting that cause back for a very, very long time. And if Donald Trump steps up, and I say this as a pro-life individual, you know, pro-life individual who's been doing this, you know, back when Donald Trump was giving money to Planned Parenthood, if he stands up and endorses something like the Alabama bill, that becomes the face of the pro-life movement for a very, very long time. And I think that this is a, you know, every Republican that I've ever talked to privately will say that one of the worst things that could possibly happen is if we were the dog that caught the car and were to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Right.
That would open, you know, the doors of electoral hell for us.
Right.
And yet that seems to be what they're all lining up behind.
One of the interesting things that's totally missing from the debate about Alabama is that it is exceptionally difficult to get an abortion there now. There's very few abortion clinics. The majority of the counties don't even have OBGYNs anymore because they've gone to other states. And that is the success of the incremental approach, which is what you want to make. If you're in the pro-life community wants to make it really hard to get an abortion. And it's interesting. So in Utah legislature just passed a bill this week saying, you know, really basically a heartbeat bill, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only two abortion clinics left in Utah. They're both in Salt Lake City. And so the Salt Lake DA, who's a Democrat, announced yesterday that he's not going to enforce this bill because he thinks it's unconstitutional. And so he's just not going to enforce it. But both of those clinics are in his jurisdiction. So it's an interesting dynamic because it is, I don't know if that represents the dog catching up with the truck. I think that's more kind of what Alabama is. But there are, in some of these very red states, they really have basically achieved what they're looking to achieve. The Supreme Court has kind of watered down the definition of undue burden and what the standard was that was there in the past. So the strategy has gotten quite a long way. And it is, I think that there is something to be said that if, you know, one of the things to watch is John Roberts.
Yes,
and, you know,
obviously.
Who's kind of upheld the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court is considering this Indiana law, which interestingly was signed by Mike Pence when he was governor of Indiana. The justices are actually deliberating again today. There was a story in the LA Times that said the justices have met 12 times now to talk about this Indiana law.
What does the Indiana law say?
So I believe that's I believe it's basically a 20-week ban. Mm-hmm. It's or something less than 20 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be if the five conservative justices want to use, they could use anything as a vehicle to roll back. Right? It doesn't have to be. They can pick the case, and in some ways, some of those guys, you know, they're smart, savvy lawyers, and they'll want the best test case possible.
And also there is some thinking, though, among the critics of incrementalism, saying that, I don't know whether referring to Indiana, but I was reading this, and I thought this was very interesting, that the incremental approaches could be upheld by the court, the court could, you know, ratify the laws without overturning Roe v. Wade. And the advantage of an Alabama bill is there's no way that you uphold that law without overturning Roe v. Wade.
Right.
So you could conceivably, if you the court, because the court can do whatever it wants, right? I mean, they can create this. John Roberts can, you
make
know,
up a new standard.
Exactly, to do this. But obviously, anybody that thought that the culture wars were not going to be front and center, you know, we can talk about economics all day, but it's going to be, you know, culture.
And that's what 2020 is going to be about. That's what Donald Trump wants to talk about. You know, I don't know that he wants to talk about the Alabama bill, but he wants to talk about NFL players kneeling. He wants to talk about immigration and caravans. And it's funny because that's just what he's comfortable with. So the economy's booming. We are close to full employment. And that's where he's always going to go. That's his impulse. And that's what 2020 is going
to. And the Democrats want to talk about intersectionality,
right?
No, I couldn't help myself from saying that. James Holman, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me. I appreciate it.
Real pleasure. Thanks,
very,
Charlie.
Very much. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.